You are listening to the podcast That's Life in Sweden, or as we say in Swedish, Sånt är livet i Sverige, with me, your host, Lisa Orsimäki. Today, I want to welcome Professor Danny Liu from the University of Sydney in Australia to the program. How are you, Danny?
I'm doing well, thanks. How are you?
Good, good. Did I say your surname correct?
Yes, that's perfect pronunciation.
Yeah, okay, because I noted a U in the end, and I have two U's at the beginning of my surname, and people have no idea how to pronounce it, so I thought, oh, I better get this right. Okay, so now, yeah, look, I'm so excited that you can give me a little bit of time to talk about your work. And so to start off with, can you just start sharing a little bit about your academic journey that I know began studying molecular biology? So what led you to then to educational technology and artificial intelligence?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I trained as a molecular biologist, did my PhD in molecular biology and cell biology. And during the PhD, I had the opportunity to work as a sessional staff member who was looking after first year biology teaching. And so during that 1 year where I was a teaching fellow, I really got bitten by the education bug and really enjoyed my time helping students to discover what biology meant for them. And after that, basically, after I finished my PhD, I asked myself, is science where I want to go or is education? And I decided on education because I had the ability to impact upon many, many lives. And so I went into 4 years of teaching fellowship after that so I could work with lots more undergraduate students. And then from then on, I basically moved into education technology as a field. And then here we are in 2024. After a year of generative AI and working with it. So I'm very excited to be working in this space.
So what led you to programming? I mean, you know, was that an interest during your time when you were studying molecular biology or has that always been an interest?
Yeah, it's a good question. I've always had an interest. So I was telling my kids the other day because we sent them to programming class during the holidays and I was sharing with them one of the experiences I had when I was in year three, I think. And one of my friends in year three, we went over to his place and he showed me Visual Basic on his computer and showed me how you could basically turn an icon of a light bulb on and off by clicking a button and writing a few lines of code. And ever since then, I've been hooked on programming, just the ability to control computers to do things that we as humans find valuable. Be it switching a icon on and off or building AI tools in order to help students learn. I think that's kind of how I started in programming. And then I just taught myself programming after that, built some things that were useful for myself and useful for other people and went from there.
Hmm. So you're not necessarily interested in the actual black box of our computers. It's more about creating the different software.
Yes, that's a good way to conceptualize it. I'm interested in using the black box of the computer to create a front-end software that is actually useful for people who need to use it. So yeah. I've always been driven by need. Necessity is a mother of invention, and so, as they say, and so I've always been driven by things that I myself find challenging or a barrier or something to something I need to do, and trying to figure out how the right piece of software, and sometimes it's software that exists and sometimes software that needs to be built, how that can help.
Well, there you are. You're gifted in technology, and this is certainly not an area that I don't really have that interest, but I understand the importance of it. But you know, and of course, I have looked you up on your LinkedIn profile, and there you describe yourself as a higher education learning and teaching whisperer. Please explain.
That's a tricky one. That was probably just me writing randomly, as one does on LinkedIn sometimes. I think technology in and higher education are at an interesting place in history, in that these new technologies coming around are almost forcing a particular transformation in how we do higher education. And a lot of colleagues, because they have a lot of things on their mind, very high workload, they don't necessarily have the time to invest to look into new technologies, how to use them, how to use them effectively for teaching and assessment. And so I guess I see my role as the go-between, as the person who connects what's happening in the technology space with what is useful in the teaching space, and helping people use technology well.
Mm-hmm. You know, the continuing changes in technology are, of course, for many quite overwhelming, especially to academics or classroom teachers who are not necessarily technologically or digitally minded. So what sort of advice would you give to those who are passionate about teaching and their students, but they struggle with digitalization?
Yes, and I think that is many people. I think the majority of people, a lot of people, and I don't think it's a problem necessarily, because everyone I come across in higher education is passionate about their research, is passionate about their students, and that's a fantastic base to start with. So I guess the approach there is that to acknowledge that technology is overwhelming, especially in the AI space. Just over the last 12 months, the pace of change has been incredible, and it's not going to slow down anytime soon. And so completely understand why people feel overwhelmed. I feel overwhelmed most days when it comes to keeping up to speed with AI. And I think it's good to acknowledge the overwhelm, but it's also good to acknowledge the passion that they do have for students and for good education, and to recognize that I guess it's one step at a time. They don't have to be across everything. That's what every university has roles like mine, where people who are there to help them marry good education and good technology together. And so to basically acknowledge that there is a challenge there, to reach out to colleagues who might have a bit more time or expertise to connect these things and to work together.
Mm-hmm. So what do you say to those teachers who kind of fear that the artificial intelligence in particular will take over their work?
Mm. It's a real fear, and completely understand where it's coming from, because especially the new kind of generation of generative AI tools out there, they seem very human, and they can be seen to, I guess, do a lot of the things that we might do as teachers. For example, creating lesson plans or acting as a tutor for students, a 24/7 tutor who never sleeps and never gets tired of answering student questions. So I think that the fear is real, and it's legitimate. But at the same time, I'd say to people that their fundamental role as a teacher is not the transference of knowledge, or even to hold discussions with students or to assess students. I think the fundamental role of a teacher is to build relationships with their students. And that's something that an AI can't do. And so if they see their role as that kind of relational aspect, I think it's very powerful that, you know, what can AI do to support your relationships with students, and to give you more time to build those relationships?
Mm. So for you, then AI is more, well, my personal belief is that technology and technological tools are merely tools to help us as educators to make sure that we get the right information, if you like, and we build on what students understand about various topics. New generative AI will basically be about the actual content, that's where it will be better many ways than what the teacher can produce. Is that what I'm hearing?
It's an interesting point. I wouldn't necessarily say that generative AI is better at content, because generative AI does hallucinate, especially on topics which it does not have as much in its training sets. And so hallucination is the enemy of content in a way, because you need accuracy when you're trying to learn content. But I think the way that I see it for teachers in thinking about how these tech tools can help us is, you know, I saw Andre Kapathy on Twitter was talking about how kind of he considers AI flipped these days into IA, which is intelligence augmentation. And that's quite useful, because we think about it in terms of how can these tools augment us as intelligent beings. And I was speaking with a student earlier today who's coming on board with a project, and their idea, one of the ideas they had is, you know, wouldn't it be great if, you know, a teacher's teaching a class of 30 students and they're working in groups of five, that means the teacher has six groups to get through in a 60-minute class period. And it's impossible for any teacher to do that. But then if the teacher was able to have an AI converse with these groups during the process of the, or during the course of the class, and then the teacher could then go around and, you know, halfway through a conversation with the AI, the teacher could then ask the AI, you know, what are the top three misconceptions this group has? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the AI could share these misconceptions, and then the teacher could then use that time more effectively with the students, build those relationships, dig into the misconceptions, help them understand better. That's a real augmentation of the teacher's intelligence.
Okay. Now, your work and interest include supporting fellow academics through professional development to understand the benefits and also the myths about artificial intelligence. Can you just share, what are the benefits? I mean, you know, I know there are benefits, but can you spell them out? And what in particular are the myths of AI?
Oh, there are so many of both. I think the main benefits of AI would be around time saving, and in terms of resource creation for students, in terms of drafting and reviewing educational resources that teachers might need to produce. But it's also about another great benefit of AI for teachers is also the ability to design and control AIs that can be given to students so that their students can have 24/7 support for whatever purpose. It could be tutoring support, it could be writing support, it could be study habits and tips support, anything that's to do with education. And so that great benefit of them freeing up a teacher's time in terms of producing resources, in terms of producing that kind of first level support for students, I think is really great. And that means that students can come to class perhaps more prepared with better questions. Students can have that ability to have an AI work with them throughout their learning to basically build up some of their basic knowledge, to build up some question asking abilities, and to just really uplift student performance. That means that the time the teacher spends with the student is more valuable. And in terms of the myths, I think some of the key myths might be around considering or viewing an AI as a search engine. I think that's a really big one because the way that these AIs work is not what we would expect the computer to work. It's actually more the way that is more like a human brain than a Google search engine. And so that's one of the fundamental misunderstandings that a lot of people coming to AI have. And it's quite a big problem to have that understanding, because it means that the way you interact with the AI, what you expect it to produce for you is going to be very different.
Mm. Now, you actually talk about why educators should consider making AI doubles of themselves. What do you mean by that?
So because this new generation of AI has the ability to act so human off a very straightforward text prompt, it's very easy for humans to basically instruct these AIs about how to behave. And so often teachers go through their teaching career and say to themselves, "Ah, if only I had a clone of myself, I would get the clone to do something."
Yeah.
So I could get the clone to talk to my student 24/7. I could get the clone to give my students some pointed feedback. I would put the clone, you know, get the clone to have discussions or role plays with my students.
Mm-hmm.
And so often we as educators, we feel, you know, if only we had that clone. And so now with the new generation of generative AIs, that is finally possible because of the great amount of understanding, I guess, that's built into these AIs and their ability to understand human commands, natural language commands. And so we kind of try and work with our educators to say, okay, well, since you can kind of now create these clones of yourself, it's just an AI clone of yourself, not a biological clone of yourself, what would you tell this clone to do?
Do you see any dangers at all with AI?
Yes. with any kind of new technology, it's really important to understand its limitations. It's important for teachers and for students to understand its limitations. So I think one of the main dangers with generative AI is not appreciating or not understanding what it's good for and what it's not so good for. I guess another danger of it is an over-reliance or building an over-reliance on these AIs, either from the teacher perspective or from the student perspective. And if you have too much over-reliance, then that starts to lead to de-skilling of either teachers or students or both. And that's a very big danger we need to keep an eye on.
And who would keep an eye on that?
It's a good question. I guess we all need to keep an eye on it for each other. We as colleagues need to keep an eye on how each other use AI to make sure that the human ingenuity and human creativity is still speaking into the resources and the lesson plans and the assessments and those kinds of things that we design for students. Because if we don't, then if we only rely on what the AI outputs for us, then and there's no kind of new ideas going into what we give to students, we're going to end up with a very boring world. So we still need to input into these AI creations or drafts a certain level of human creativity in order to keep, keep the humanness alive in education.
The other, and it of course relates to this question, so how can educators help students use artificial intelligence responsibly, productively, and ethically, as well as themselves, if I might add?
I think a very big part of doing that, educators helping students, is actually through modeling. So educators should model the effective and safe and productive use of AI. So if they use AI in the production of resources or to build chatbots that their teachers that their students can have a conversation with, then they need to be transparent about that. They say, you know, oh, they need to say, I use AI in these particular ways, and this is the reason why I use it. And by explaining that to students, they explain the why as well as the how. And as we all try and build up our AI literacy, that modeling will be really important. And in terms of how educators can help other educators use it well, I think it's sharing. It's sharing some ideas, some approaches, some strategies, some prompts that you might use in order that you use AI effectively. And also sharing not just the things that worked well, but also sharing the things that didn't work so well, so we can all learn from each other.
So do you think there is an issue of equity when it comes to AI?
Yeah, I think a really, really great thing to think about in terms of where we are at right now with AI. I think there's two main interrelated ideas around equity and generative AI. One is definitely around that kind of can we afford it, or can people, students, teachers, institutions afford it? And the other one is, can they, even if they have access to it, can they use it? So there's both a access and also a skill divide here. So even in Australia, this last year, the independent and private schools, they were mostly allowing their students, so this is K-12 education, they were mostly allowing their students to use generative AI, whereas the public system blocked the use of generative AI and disallowed these generative AI. So coming into first year university this year, we're going to get two groups of students, one group which has had a year to get used to this, and another group which have been basically banned from using this. Not that the ban worked, because they're reversed. So there definitely is a skill divide. And also in terms of the access divide, I think it's the responsibility of institutions themselves to ensure that these AIs are available. And a lot of institutions and also vendors as well, like Microsoft, OpenAI themselves, we all need to work together to work out how we can make this equitable, because, you know, just like the internet, this is going to be the next big thing that people will need to know how to use well. And if they don't, then it's going to create an even more massive digital divide. And so institutions and vendors need to work together to basically provide this level of access to students for free, essentially. Otherwise, their students are going to be left behind.
Yes. And I guess that's one of my concerns when I think about this incredible development of technology. I mean, I'm sure the computers in the end, we probably will be using, I'm not sure if computers will be what will take the place of our computers, I don't know. But I'm sure there will be new ideas and new gadgets, if you like, that will replace. Which brings me, because when we talk about this divide, and that is a real concern that I have when I think about students, because I do have those students in my classes who has got access to the latest gadgets. They have access to ChatGPT-4 or whatever they have. And then you have those that don't have access. And there is a great divide among students. So, and of course, not only students, but also among teachers and academics, even at university level. So my question now is, what is your perspective on what sort of professional development academics and teachers should be offered by universities or schools right now?
I think one of the barriers currently for educators is fear and time. It's time to look into these things, and it's also fear of the unknown, and also perhaps fear of what this might mean, like you were mentioning before, what this might mean for their jobs, but also what this might mean that they need to do about their curriculum, about their assessment, about their teaching, because all academics across the world are overworked they're balancing a lot of priorities. And so this is yet another thing that has been thrown at them that they need to deal with. And so I think the CPD that is needed right now for educators is a little bit of familiarity building, a little bit of myth busting to try and dispel some of those fears, and also really just seeing how in very small ways they can start to use these tools in very simple, small ways to start to save their own time or to make learning better for their students. Because fundamentally, we're all invested in students and their learning. And so if academics can see some kind of real tangible benefit from it, that's a real key, I guess, goal of CPD.
And, you know, one of the things, I mean, involved in a project where we are looking at, here in Europe, it's a European project, we're looking at micro-credentials in order to validate teachers' knowledge, because a lot of teachers, they may say, well, I don't have a lot of experience or knowledge of technology, yet they do actually have, when you start taking your time and you start talking to them about, well, how are you using, what sort of tools are you using when you present material to your students, how are, you know, and suddenly they are actually using technology. But here in Europe, so one thing, and I know it's happening in Australia, you've got micro-credentials in order to validate teachers, you know, their knowledge. It's just like small, I don't know, it might be of help, because certainly, and that's how I'm seeing it, that it will help a lot of educators who do have knowledge, but they still feel, I think, I wonder if it's about lack of confidence.
I always think back to the way that we all learnt how to use smartphones or the internet, because these generative AIs are the next general purpose technology, the technology which kind of changes society. We didn't read a manual to use the internet. We didn't take a micro-credential to learn how to use it. We just used it. We switched on the computer and used it. And so I think my feeling is with generative AI, it's largely the same thing. It's just something that will be there and people just need to try and make mistakes and learn from their peers and have conversations and discussions and just try it out. I think micro-credentials are good ways of formal learning for a lot of different skills and knowledge. But for generative AI, I think, yes, for some people it will be the right thing to do a micro-credential and to pick up some basic knowledge. But I think for many people, it's just a matter of just giving it a go.
I tend to agree when you just mention it that, look, it's a natural thing. It became a natural thing to start using the computer and even our phones, how we send messages, and we have different platforms that we can use. So that was actually a really good point that you made there. Now, you're involved with two projects. One is empowering teachers and students with generative AI through Cogniti. What is that about?
So we recognized early last year that there are a number of issues with generative AI in an educational context. One was, and we mentioned this already, was about equity of access, that, you know, not all students can afford GPT-4 access, and GPT-4 is, you know, worlds apart from GPT-3.5. And so we wanted a way to kind of get GPT-4 in the hands of students. But we also had teachers saying, you know, well, we don't know how students are using it. And also we have no control over how they use these really powerful AIs. But we would really like to be able to both, you know, be able to steer these AIs, but also be able to and kind of get a feeling of how students are interacting with these so we can help them better. And we also had other problems around AI, like, we don't always trust that particular vendors to do it. And so how do we, you know, have secure, private, trustworthy connections to these AIs? And so all those problems kind of led us to think about, well, why don't we try and build some software that could actually answer all of those questions and more? And so Cogniti, we started developing this in about March, April last year, and piloting it now with a number of different institutions. And basically with Cogniti, it's an AI wrapper, AI platform, that allows teachers to basically control the behavior of these powerful AIs give their students access to these controlled AIs, which can act in particular educational ways. And the cost is borne by the institution. And so students don't have to pay, staff don't have to pay. It's all institutionally costed, and it's run on secure platforms, which don't go into training future AIs and those kind of things. And so it's our kind of attempt to give control of AI into the hands of people who are teaching, and give access of these controlled AIs and private secure AIs into the hands of students.
Then the second one is called personalizing teacher-student interactions with data using the student relationship engagement system.
So that's a project which we've had going for about 12 years now. And that is not so much around generative AI, but it is around giving teachers access to the right data at the right time in order to be able to tailor support and feedback to their students at massive scale. So that is using another system called the SRES, Student Relationship Engagement System, that we've produced at Sydney. And that is, that's not so much generative AI, but it also is just the idea of giving teachers the ability to use data in a good way to support their students.
So what's next for you? Do you have a personal project happening? Apart from your children, of course.
I often say SRES is my first child. The twins are my second and third, and then Cogniti is my fourth. And so I think Cogniti will probably keep me busy enough for a little while longer as we all ride this generative AI train together. So I think, I think my passion with generative AI now is to make sure that it's put into the hands of educators in a trustworthy and controlled and safe way, so that they can start to produce these AI doubles of themselves to help their own students out. Because like we mentioned before, one of the things that educators often say is, I wish I had a clone of myself that could do X, and Cogniti now allows me to do that.
You know, when you say, you know, I mean, what an ambitious thing to say. I mean, to make something really safe and secure and that no one can hack into. Is that really possible?
So I guess nothing in the world, nothing software in the world is 100% hack-proof. But I guess when it comes to generative AI, when we say safe and secure, we mean things like it doesn't, the conversations don't, or the data doesn't get used for training further AIs. The data is as secure as can be, stored on things like Microsoft Azure servers, so that it's all protected by those kind of enterprise grade security, that institutions have control and visibility over how the AI is being used. And so they have that kind of level of trust, as opposed to the open systems where basically anything can happen and we have no idea how students are using it.
And that's the worry. Mm. I'm thinking that's the worry for me, you know, it's but look, finally, is there anything that you want to share that is important to you and that I have not mentioned?
I think what the recent developments in artificial intelligence are helping us to realize is that we need to start preparing not for generative AI, but for artificial general intelligence, which could potentially be just a number of years away. And artificial general intelligence, or AGI, is an AI which can basically do anything that a human can do, and potentially better. We're running around in higher education now trying to deal with this very, not simple, but compared to AGI, simple idea of generative AI, which can, you know, write essays and make images and create music and those kind of things. But coming soon, people think, is artificial general intelligence. And the big question for human society, I think, at the point in time when AGI will come around, is we're going to be in a very similar position to where we are now. We're going to be running around again saying, oh no, now we have an AI that can basically do everything that we can do. What is the point of us? Yeah. And the sooner we can ask that question of ourselves and our students and our education systems, the better.
But, you know, and of course, that brings me the final question, which is, which one would you fear, or which one would you fear? Is it AI or the one that you just mentioned? Would it be climate change or the incredible unrest around the world that is happening right now? Which one would you say would be scary?
I think they're all independently scary, and together they're all quite scary as well. I think they all overlap and interrelate. I think what we need to think about is maybe turning some of the scarier things that have potential benefits, like the potential or artificial general intelligence, and thinking about how we can use that to perhaps help us think through scientific breakthroughs to solve, well, not solve, but to alleviate climate change, or to alleviate political misinformation and conflict. These AIs can be used for bad, but they can also be used for good. And I think as we work together as a society to deal with what these AIs can do, we can hopefully discover ways that we can use them for to improve the way that we're living and the way that we're using the world.
Yes, and so there is the disinformation that we need to be aware of, and that we need to continuously, I guess, as educators, to make sure that we talk about it in our classes and with our students and even with our colleagues. And the same thing goes for the benefits. And that's where, you know, when you just mentioned that about the benefits, I'm thinking about, you know, we have, I think there is quite a lot of research going into, you know, how can we instead of using fossil fuels, how can we use technology in order to, we don't have to dig in our earths and dig out the gas and, you know. So, yeah, there are a lot of good things, but we need people like you, Danny.
I just play a very small part in this. I think that amazing scientific breakthroughs that are being made in computer science, in biology, in chemical engineering, those kind of things, that's where the magic happens.
Good for you, or as they say in Australia, good on you.
Thank you, you're too kind.
Thank you so much, Danny, for your time and generosity sharing with us about your work and perspectives about artificial intelligence. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Lisa. You asked fantastic questions.
And you have been listening to the podcast Sånt är livet I Sverige, or in English, That's Life, here in Sweden, with me, Lisa Orsimäki. Till next time, take care of yourself and each other. Bye for now.